Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and while some of Harvey Weinstein's private misconduct can be traced back to 1991, the early 90s were the beginning of a cultural shift, a very public one, to believing women with stories of sexual misconduct. That, of course, refers to Anita Hill's testimony at the Senate confirmation of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. Now, the Me Too movement and new allegations may be grounds for Judge Thomas's impeachment. At least that's the argument in the cover story of New York Magazine this week. Joining me now to follow up on what's really been her decades-long reporting on Justice Thomas and whether impeachment is possible now that there are new allegations is Jill Abramson, political columnist for The Guardian. She was the executive editor, that is the top dog, at The New York Times and co-author with Jane Mayer, who's now at The New Yorker, of the 1994 book, Strange Justice, The Selling of Clarence Thomas. Jill's latest piece in New York Magazine is that cover story titled The Case for Impeaching Clarence Thomas, hashtag him too. Hi, Jill. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thanks.
So people are exhausted enough figuring out if they can impeach Donald Trump. Are you seriously raising the notion of impeaching Clarence Thomas?
Well, I'm seriously raising it in terms of the totality of the evidence that Clarence Thomas perjured himself in order to be confirmed back in 1991. As a political matter, I don't realistically think the Republican House and Senate are going to take up the impeachment of a justice who they admire and support wholeheartedly.
Let me play, even in the context of that answer, where the case for impeachment of Clarence Thomas may not literally lead to the impeachment of Clarence Thomas, let me play a 30-second clip from those Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings that you cite in the article as, I guess, an example of perjury. He's being questioned here by Senator Orrin Hatch, Republican from Utah, about some of the sexually inappropriate things that he allegedly said to Anita Hill.
Did you ever say in words or substance something like, there is a pubic hair in my Coke?
No, Senator.
Did you ever refer to your private parts in conversations with Professor Hill?
Absolutely not, Senator.
Did you ever brag to Professor Hill about your sexual prowess?
No, Senator.
Did you ever use the term long dong silver in conversation with Professor Hill? Had you?
No, Senator.
So 25 years before Donald Trump.
Right. I was actually sitting in the hearing room listening to that testimony. I was covering the confirmation hearings for the Wall Street Journal at that point.
So how did it strike you then? And with all these years of hindsight, that was 1992, how does, 91 or 92? I think 92.
It was 91.
91, sorry. How did, with, you know, Trump and Harvey Weinstein and Me Too and everything else you've experienced since 1991, how did it strike you then and how does it strike you now?
Well, it struck me then that, you know, Anita Hill testified and she was this lone woman saying these very painful things about what her boss, who at the time was the nation's chief watchdog against sexual harassment, had said to her in the office, describing pornographic movies to her in the office, speaking in other sexualized ways, and asking her that bizarre question, who put pubic hair on my Coke? I can actually remember looking, I was sitting at the press table at that point across from Maureen Dowd, who was covering the hearings for the New York Times, and our eyes locked. We just couldn't believe we were hearing the words pubic hair in the Senate at that point. Sexual harassment was such a new concept back then, unfamiliar term to most people. But, you know, and Anita Hill herself, other than her own experiences, did not have access to the considerable body of evidence from other women that Clarence Thomas had said these inappropriate things to other women in the workplace. And so she was very much the image was of a lone accuser who in real time, according to public opinion polls taken back in at the time of the hearings, most of the country believed Clarence Thomas and not Anita Hill when those hearings ended.
So you found new evidence for your book, which is years old now, and anything new for this article that leads you to conclude that he was guilty of lying under oath in that clip that we played and more?
Well, yes, Brian. And I think what really made an impression on me is that post-2010, which is not that many years ago, you know, Clarence Thomas has been on the U.S. Supreme Court a good long time by then. But, you know, if you just look at things at that point, you have, number one, a woman named Lillian McEwen, who had a long-term relationship with Clarence Thomas at the point of the hearings, coming forward to say that, you know, what Anita Hill testified had rang true to her in real time back in 1991, but that Clarence Thomas had asked her not to say anything, so that she had remained silent. But she knew he was a habitual user of pornography and loved just the kinds of movies, like you heard Orrin Hatch say a character's name, Long Dong Silver, bingo, you know, that struck a bell with Lillian McEwen. So there was Lillian McEwen. There was, you know, still another woman who back in 1991 had covered Clarence Thomas as a journalist, and had told a colleague of hers that Thomas would make these just inappropriate, bizarre comments about what he found a sexual turn on and that kind of thing to her. She didn't feel he was harassing her, but she just thought it was weird, mm-hmm. told her colleague. And when Anita Hill came forward, her colleague tried to pressure her to contact the Judiciary Committee. And she said to her, you know, what you've told me could, you know, make such a difference. It would make people believe Anita Hill. But she said, I don't want to stick my head up and say anything because Clarence Thomas is an important source of mine. So that's number two. And, you know,
One of the corroborative stories you wrote about from Angela Wright Shannon, who worked for Judge Thomas at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission when he ran that for the first President Bush, you write, would have been the most devastating witness. How come?
Because she was, quote unquote, the other woman. As long as Clarence Thomas's Republican supporters in the Senate could isolate Anita Hill and have her be the lone accuser, they thought they could just push him through, which they did. But if there was another accuser, all bets were off. So that the effort to keep Angela Wright from testifying or making any kind of public appearance during the hearings was intense. And in fact, I think it was Arlen Specter went to Joe Biden, who was the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, and said to him, "Your Angela Wright is Angela wrong," you know, trying to intimidate him
Republican Senator Arlen Specter, right, of Connecticut.
The late, who
later apologized for some of his behavior toward Anita Hill at that hearing.
Yeah, he and I had some interesting conversations about this over the years, and I think he had come to second guess his role in being such a vehement supporter of Clarence Thomas during the hearings and an attacker of Anita Hill, savage.
And listeners, if you have a question for Jill Abramson, former executive editor of the New York Times, now the writer of the cover story in New York Magazine, this week called The Case for Impeachment of Clarence Thomas, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Let's stay on that history. And Arlen Specter had regrets. The chairman of the Judiciary Committee, and it's the Judiciary Committee which holds confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominees, was Joe Biden.
Right.
And your reporting says Biden knew of quite a few corroborative stories for Anita Hill, what you call potential Me Toos, but did not call on them to testify. What did Joe Biden do?
Well, Joe Biden basically did nothing. And I should point out, he too recently, in an interview with Teen Vogue, at least apologized to Anita Hill and that he said he had insufficiently protected her from Republican attacks. But his mishandling of these hearings went beyond that. And he basically let the Republicans on the committee force him into an agreement, a kind of gentleman's agreement, that there would be no evidence in the hearings about Clarence Thomas's quote-unquote private use of pornography. Now, I'm the first to say anyone who wants to enjoy pornography, you know, it's a free country. But his use of pornography was directly germane to Anita Hill's testimony. And so agreeing before the hearings just not to let anyone with information about that subject, you know, be part of the evidentiary part of the confirmation process was absurd. And I to this day don't understand, other than, you know, it was back in 1991 and no one really understood sexual harassment that deeply except for experts on the issue. Why on earth he made that agreement?
Angela Wright, that other woman who you said would have been the most devastating witness, wrote an op-ed in Huffington Post, as you know, just this week.
Right.
Explaining her side of the story and why she thinks she wasn't believed. She wrote, all those men were white and the women who accused Thomas were all African-American. It's easy to imagine the hearings ending in a very different outcome if the accusers had been white.
Right. That is significant, too. And the woman I was just mentioning, who was the journalist who had knowledge, she's white. So who knows? That might have made a difference if she'd come forward.
And so let me go back to one other clip from his confirmation hearings. If gender was breaking out as an issue because of Anita Hill's accusations. In his opening statement, Clarence Thomas tried to trump that, you might say,
with race.
And here it is.
And from my standpoint, as a black American, as far as I'm concerned, it is a high-tech lynching for uppity blacks who in any way deign to think for themselves, to do for themselves, to have different ideas. And it is a message that unless you kowtow to an old order, this is what will happen to you. You will be lynched, destroyed, caricatured by a committee of the U.S. Senate rather than hung from a tree.
So as a matter of history, and we have so many listeners.
Ooh, that sends a shiver
right?
up my spine.
Doesn't
even
it?
Hearing it.
And
these
I remember
many years
that
later.
Statement. But we have many listeners who were not around yet for the Clarence Thomas hearings and must be getting shivers up their spines right now thinking, oh my God, that happened. And this ultra-conservative Supreme Court justice was invoking racial discrimination
right.
in such an explicit way. How was it viewed at the time? And do you think it made an impact on the confirmation vote by the Senate?
It was viewed at the time as, you know, the bold, shocking, stop you in your tracks statement that it is today. But what it did is it was a brilliant political masterstroke because it put into bold relief this all-white, all-male, too, Senate Judiciary Committee.
And was there even one, was there one black woman
Not yet elected. You're thinking of Carol Moseley Braun was elected as senator from Illinois year following the hearings.
Oh, of course, because
the beginning of the uprising of the year of the woman and the angry roar of women because Anita Hill had not been believed.
So the Senate was almost all male and all white.
All white at that point.
Well, let's take a phone call.
Sure.
How about Kai in Manhattan? Kai, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. I'm not really, I'm a big sport watcher. Like, I read a lot about the sport, and I'm not really a fan of Clarence Thomas, and I don't think he should have been confirmed in the first place. But if we can't, I don't think we can really relitigate a lot of these confirmation hearings. And if we're talking about actually impeaching a justice, I don't think that should be an easy thing. And I mean, if you look at the Constitution, it talks about they're allowed to serve for life as long as they're on good behavior. And really, there haven't been any allegations against him while he's been on the court. And so trying to impeach him now, I think, would be too political.
Okay, thank you. Jill?
Well, it isn't true that there have been no allegations since he's been on the court. There's a female lawyer in Alaska, Moira Smith, who says that at a dinner in Washington back in 1999, which he was already on the court for quite some years at that point, that he cupped her rear end as she was laying out place cards and setting the table for a dinner they were both attending. And so it's not true that his conduct has not been called into question since he's been on the court. And I just point out that there are other federal judges who also enjoy lifetime appointments who have been impeached because they lied and because of perjury.
You reference in your article some kind of document related to the Hillary Clinton campaign where the topic of impeaching Clarence Thomas was raised.
It was, you know, in the reams of material that were made public during the 2016 campaign, once Hillary Clinton's private email server became such a big controversy. Among the documents that passed through her computer while she is Secretary of State was a memo that was prepared for her called Impeaching Clarence Thomas. And it laid out in quite some detail the considerable body of evidence from the time of the hearings.
Did she react to it in any way that's
not
known?
Not that we know.
Caroline in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Jill Abramson. Hi.
Hi, I just wanted to bring up the story that was The New Yorker recently that Jane Mayer wrote about the conflict of interest regarding his wife, Ginny Thomas.
Right, yes.
And her work with Turning Point and her other conservative and alt-right activities.
Yeah. Do you have a question about that?
I'm sorry, I can't hear what,
you. Oh, your question is whether that's a conflict of interest for a sitting justice?
And I've heard that I've heard this before, that it might be a conflict of interest.
Yeah, well, I think that Jane Mayer is, you know, the single best investigative reporter working in Washington these days.
Your co-author, I should say.
And I must disclose, my best friend in life. So,
and co-author on your book about Clarence Thomas from years ago.
I mean, spousal conflict, which is the subject the caller raises, is, you know, it's a somewhat murky area, but it's unusual at the very least for a Supreme Court, a sitting Supreme Court justice's wife, to be as active in partisan politics as Ginni Thomas
is. It's interesting that the Republicans are raising spousal conflict of interest now with respect to that FBI employee.
Right.
Is it Andrew McCabe?
Right.
Justice Department official who they kind of forced out partly on the basis of
His wife had gotten Democratic donations.
That's right.
Running for office in Virginia. That's right.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We are New York and New Jersey Public Radio. With a few more minutes with Jill Abramson, former executive editor of the New York Times, now, among other things, a political columnist at The Guardian and the author of the cover story in New York Magazine this week called The Case for Impeaching Clarence Thomas. Do you want to say something about your old institution, the failing New York Times?
Yeah, right. Ha, ha, ha.
And its role in the new environment?
Sure. I would just love to say I'm so proud of the Times's exemplary work on, you know, breaking the Harvey Weinstein story, you know, doing Bill O'Reilly on and on. They just have kept digging and investigating and telling the truth and holding very powerful figures to account. And it's just been such a public service, truly. That's why there's a First Amendment. We're supposed to hold power accountable. And, you know, they've been doing it in the most stellar fashion. Hats off.
Do you have any analysis or prediction about how mainstream journalism, standard quality journalism, comes out of the Trump administration, how much he succeeds in delegitimizing them in how many people's eyes versus, you know, the new kind of passionate advocacy for the press that a lot of people have?
You know, I think it's a very delicate balance because on the one hand, you have the reality that places like the New York Times and the Washington Post and the New Yorker have never been doing more important, better work. And yet, you know, the levels of public distrust in the news media are still quite high. The readership and audience for these stories is highly polarized. So you have a situation, alas, where most of us are kind of preaching to the converted, which is not healthy for the dissemination of quality information in our society. So, you know, if you're asking me who will win this sort of war between President Trump and the quote-unquote fake news media, you know, I've been watching politics a long time. I'm not ready to predict.
How about anything that you might think the elite media, to call it that, needs to do better in order to not leave so many Americans vulnerable to demagoguery trying to alienate them further from the press?
I think what we need to do is to do our work and to go out in the country and listen to people. Listen. That's more of that needs to happen.
We will leave it there for today with Jill Abramson, political columnist for The Guardian, former executive editor of The New York Times, co-author with Jane Mayer of the 1994 book Strange Justice, The Selling of Clarence Thomas, and now the author of the cover story on New York Magazine. If anybody looks at newsstands anymore, your eyes probably popped out of your head when you walked past one this week and you saw New York Magazine sitting there and a big picture of Clarence Thomas and the headline, The Case for Impeaching Clarence Thomas. She wrote it. Jill, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much, Brian.